Welcome, Photon Warriors. Commence strategic maneuvers at audible command signal. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, begin.
Jackalope Radio presents Movies Hate You. Movies Hate You, with your host, Rob Housechild.
Yeah, well, what's that?
That was me.
Hey, welcome.
Sorry.
Everybody quiet. Welcome to the Movies Hate You show.
Welcome to the Movies Hate You show.
That never gets old. That
we're never going to get away from that, are we?
It never gets new.
Well, I am the aforementioned Mr. Housechild. To my left is the incredible Mystery Lee Peterson.
Hello.
Lee Peterson. That's right.
No jokes?
Everyone knows you as Mr. Ree. No noodle jokes. Tell you, we're gonna keep your noodle out of it.
Keep it under wraps.
That's right. We're gonna keep it under wraps. On the boards, producing Todd Sheets. Yes, that Todd Sheets, the one who made movies. Now he's making radio, and it's just as bad as the movies he made.
Oh.
I'm just kidding, Todd.
I told you that,
Todd. Yeah, I know. I'm the one usually defending your movies to you.
I know. I'm the one telling you they suck.
Well, here we are. We're live. We are live. And you can't call in this week, so we're not giving you the number because we have a special guest coming on this week in about 10 minutes. So stick with us here at the Movies Hate You show, sponsored by Wild Eye Releasing.
That's Incorporated. Right.
Incorporated. No, it's actually LLC. What do I know? Anyway, so on the Wild Eye front, today is the drop date for Richard Griffin's new film from us called Exhumed. You see that one yet, Todd? Is that over there in your local Best Buy?
I haven't seen it yet, but I did notice mold was around.
Yeah, mold's hanging around. That's a really great thing to hear.
Nice.
Yeah. Well, Exhumed will be around shortly, hopefully. Richard Griffin's new film. Yes, it's black and white. Yes, it's awesome. Debbie Rochon.
We love Debbie. Debbie's
we love great. Debbie. Her performance in this, let me tell you something. Yeah, you say, oh, yeah, Debbie Rochon, she's been in a lot of stuff. This is really incredible stuff.
Takes her to a new level.
Star turn.
Chainsaw Award material?
Chainsaw Award. No, it's Oscar Award.
Oh, okay.
Right? Is that what they call them? The Oscar Awards?
The Oscar... Yeah, something like that.
Speaking of Oscars, we've got Man of Steel opening this week. Todd, did you see Man of Steel?
I did.
Were you dressed like Batman when you went to see it?
No.
Were you out? We weren't out front of the theater dressed like Batman?
No, but I did have a Superman cape on.
So you have a Superman get up as well.
I just had the cape.
Incredible. How was the movie?
I loved it.
That means it sucks. Okay.
Wait a second. You're saying that Man of Steel is a Superman movie? How did you get that? I mean,
the Man of Steel is Superman.
It's called Man of Steel. It's not.
Right, but that's Superman. Like, you know, well, that's like The Dark Knight. It's a Batman movie.
That was a Batman movie?
Yeah, that was a Batman movie.
Serious?
Yeah.
Huh.
I thought it was
seriously.
Martin Lawrence.
Huh, okay.
What'd you say, Todd?
I said, I think Mr. Ree thought it was a Martin Lawrence movie.
You thought it was a Freddie Prinze Jr. film. All right, so I figured this out. Last week, or the week before, I forget, I had said, how does a studio get from The Rock to Larry the Cable Guy as the Tooth Fairy in the sequel? So I just want to answer that before we get to our very special guests in just a few minutes. So you start with The Rock, and then you do Tooth Fairy, right?
Okay.
And
okay.
That's the movie, right?
The Tooth Fairy?
The Tooth
Rock,
Fairy.
Rock.
The Rock.
Dwayne Johnson.
Big hit. He won't come back for the second one. Doesn't want to do a sequel.
Hmm.
Okay. So then you got to go down the list, and you eventually get to Larry the Cable Guy. And this is how it went down in my eyes. These are all the no's that led to Larry the Cable Guy. All right. So Rock says no. Vin Diesel. He says no. He says no. He did a kids film one. Yeah. He says no.
The pacifier.
Then they say, well, maybe we need to stick with wrestling. Steve Austin. He says, go to hell.
Okay.
No way. Then they say, okay, let's change up our game here. Cuba Gooding Jr.
Hmm.
Won't touch it. Even too much for him.
Hmm.
Then they say, all right, we have to lower our standards a little bit here. We go to Billy Zane.
Ah.
Yeah, Billy Zane is the tooth fairy.
Hmm.
He'd be a good tooth fairy.
Hmm.
No way. Won't do it.
You're still going with bald guys, except for Cuba.
Well, we're you know, you'll know my you'll see how it connects. Maybe.
Why not Wayne Brady?
Then we go to get off my bit. All right. Then we go to Christian Slater.
Hmm.
Absolutely not available. And we say, okay, see Thomas Howell.
Hmm.
Unavailable. And we say, okay, let's really need to cast this thing in the next 15 minutes. George Lopez. No, he won't do it. He's already got three movies coming out. He can't do it. Then they say Harvey Fierstein.
Hmm.
That's where they go.
And then Larry the Cable Guy.
And then Larry the Cable Guy. Hmm. So that's how you get from The Rock to Larry the Cable Guy in the casting office of a studio.
Huh.
Yeah.
I would love to know how accurate that is. If any of those people were approached and turned it down.
I bet you that it's more accurate than you would think.
Yeah. Well, Vin Diesel probably gets every offer that The Rock turns down. No offense, Vin, but it was probably reversed a few years ago. Now The Rock gets first pick.
But then what happens when they're both in the same film together?
You're talking another Expendables kind of thing, right?
They already were in a film together.
Which were they in?
Fast Five.
That's true.
And
that's
the new
true.
One,
and
too,
fast,
I think. Yeah,
Faster Sixer.
Faster Sixer? How do you say that? Faster Sixer.
Faster Sixer.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Superman's making a lot of money, Todd?
Yeah.
It's
making a lot.
There you go.
$130 million,
right?
Yeah, I guess the worldwide take was $210.
I'm gonna see it tomorrow and let you guys know how it is. Mr. Ree, you missed it, right?
I'm going to see it on Sunday.
Sunday?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
For Father's Day, you're going to take Jack.
You just missed Father's Day.
Our reoccurring guest, Jack, you're going to bring him.
Jack and I are going to go
nobody
on
cares.
Sunday.
Nobody cares.
Sunday.
Hey, Mr. Ree.
Mr. Ree.
Yo.
How much do you like the John Breen Supermans?
What is he saying?
How much do I like what?
Todd, how's your Wi-Fi over there? We can barely hear you.
Yeah, it's this damn thing.
I can hear you fine.
The John Breen, you know?
John who?
Breen.
John Breen?
Who's that?
That's the amazing storyteller who in the DC Comics kind of did a series of Superman books that were kind of more grounded in the real universe.
Hmm.
Kind of thing. They tried. I mean, it's Superman. You can't ground it a lot, but they grounded it a little bit more in the real world and
grounded Superman.
This is my problem with not having seen the movie. And of course, I will see the movie, and I'm sure I'll love it. But my problem is this whole idea of updating and the idea of making it realistic. It's Superman.
Well, you gotta remember that was John Breen, and what was that? The 80s. I mean, he did that a long time ago. He was trying to do something a little different because at that time people were complaining that it was too fanciful. You know, Superman never had any real life or death questions or any real trauma. So they were trying to kind of just give him enough spin to kind of get those naysayers back because they were trying to bring people back to the comics at that time. A lot of people had quit reading comic books and they were bringing them back in, trying to do things like, you know, Frank Miller came in and did Batman Year One and things like that because they were trying to pull in more mature readers, and that's why John Breen stepped in and did a story, and that's kind of where they followed a little bit with the new film. It's not exact, but they followed it a little bit with the John Breen stuff.
Oh, well, that's a problem with Superman. Unless you give him an equal nemesis, there's really, which they do in this film, but like the debacle that came before this, the return of Superman or whatever, Superman Returns, that was the problem, is that how do you feel nothing for a character that is a god and can basically just destroy the whole planet if he wants to.
Well, we have Kryptonite. I mean, Kryptonite is the...
Do we?
I don't know if
very
it's,
hard
in, the,
to
if
get
it's
it.
In the new film.
I'm
but
sure
I mean,
it is.
That's the angle that always kind of...
Is there Kryptonite in the new film?
No.
Okay.
Is Superboy in the new film?
No.
Is Super Dog in the new film?
No.
Crypto?
Crypto? Remember Little Crypto? How about Supergirl?
No. No.
Huh.
No, really? No Supergirl, huh?
Nope.
I'm not liking this one already. I thought they were trying to go for like an Avengers thing.
No, not yet.
Not yet. Oh, they're setting up. Did they set up? Is there a little Dark Knight reference in there? Are they setting up a Justice League?
There is actually some references to other heroes in this deal.
Is there?
Well, that's good to know.
Okay, so they are setting up a Justice League.
They're kind of trying to get close, I think.
Is there a zinger at the end after the credits?
No.
Really?
Warner's has never done that.
Oh, how stupid.
That's a Marvel thing.
It's an anybody thing.
Well, yeah.
Right?
Joe Dante is the one that started it in my memory.
Yep.
I remember The Howling sticking around after the credits.
Which comes out today on Blu-ray.
Hey, there you go.
Hey. There you go. The little plug there for Shout Factory.
And speaking of Joe Dante, maybe it's time to segue into our guest here.
Well, that sounds good.
Perhaps.
All right. Let's see. Who you got for us?
Well, let's see. How do we preface this? Gremlins. Gremlins came out in whatever year that came out in, 84, I believe, 83. Yeah. Same day as Ghostbusters.
That's right. I saw both in the same theater. Same day. Snuck into one. Paid for one, snuck into the other.
That's the way to do it. This is how we do it. I was a huge fan of The Howling, so I would have seen Joe Dante's follow-up no matter what it was, and loved it. And it's since become a perennial Christmas movie in my household.
It's an excellent Christmas film.
Fantastic Christmas
film. It was a Christmas film for little horror fans.
Exactly. And my 7-year-old daughter, Casey, it's her favorite movie now. And she's watched it, I think, three years in a row now, or 2 years in a row, and loves it. She's scared every time, but loves the feeling of being scared and catharsis and whatever. Anyway, that's Gremlins. Our guest this evening is star of Gremlins. He plays Billy... What was his last name?
I forget, Todd.
Todd, does anybody have Wikipedia here?
Yeah.
Zach Galligan is the fellow.
Zach Galligan with us tonight. Awesome.
Gremlins, Gremlins 2. He was in Waxwork. If you remember Waxwork
from the
80s. Waxwork 2.
Even better.
Even better than 1. He's in a new movie called Hatchet 3, which is awesome.
I mean, there are a legion of Hatchet fans out there, so they know all about this. They know Zach's
absolutely
all over this movie,
and it's on VOD.
Yep.
Already. It's playing limited theatrical New York.
It's killer. It's nonstop action.
It's just nonstop.
It's crazy. But we'll let Zach talk about it. Bring him on, Todd. Come on,
I'm
Mr.
doing
producer.
It. I'm working it out.
Let's do this.
We're doing.
He's
it.
Working it out. Meanwhile, Zach's like, "You bastard."
Live radio, folks.
It's what it is.
Hello.
Hey, Zach, it's Lee. How are you?
Hey, Lee. How are you, dude?
Very good. Thanks. Welcome to the Movies Hate You Show. I'm joined by Rob and Todd.
Hello.
Hey, Zach.
Hey, guys.
Hey, thanks for coming on, man.
No problem.
Yeah, thanks so much. Let's talk about Hatchet 3 first. We've seen...
You're not going to ask him how he's doing first?
Okay, sorry. How you doing?
Yeah, how you doing, Zach?
I'm doing pretty good. Can't complain.
Okay, excellent.
Now you can talk about Hatchet 3.
Okay, Hatchet 3. Hatchet 3 is, as I was saying, is available on VOD.
Yep.
It's playing limited theatrical, New York and L.A., and I think other cities to follow. I saw it last weekend. It's fantastic. It's wall-to-wall, nonstop action, humor, gore. The gore is just set to 11. It's hilarious. You know, I saw the opening night, and the crowd was so enthusiastic. They cheered when Adam Green had a cameo. Okay, that's how enthusiastic they were.
It's a hardcore. Hatchet has such a hardcore following. I mean, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah,
it's insane. Zach, the movie seemed like a ton of fun to make. Just like a bunch of friends got together and went insane. Is that how it was on the set?
Well, I think it probably would have been like that had we not been shooting in such dire conditions in the swamp. I mean, it was pretty ugly. It was pretty nasty in terms of mosquitoes and bugs and insects and thunderstorms and mud and spiders and snakes and gators and humidity and being fully dressed in costumes. And so it was fun a lot of the time, and then a lot of the time it was just plain grueling because the swamp is alive and essentially wants to eat you if you stand still.
Were there any mishaps on set? Anybody get sick or bitten by snakes?
Oh, yeah. People got bitten by spiders. Like, some of the grips had really nasty spider bites on their hands that were, like, all brown and nasty, like a rotten banana. And one person decided that they had enough of the mosquitoes, and so they were going to use something called DEET, which is like an extra strong kind of sort of insect repellent. And the person used too much of it. And I don't know if you know this, but if you use too much DEET, you can literally start to hallucinate and see stuff that isn't there. So that person had to be rushed to the hospital with DEET poisoning.
I have no idea about that. That's insane. I have to see the behind the scenes for this movie. It's going to be great.
I don't know how much of it's going to be visible in the behind the scenes thing. I don't really recall that much of a behind the scenes thing being made, but we'll see. I'm sure you'll see some of the hardship for sure.
Now, were you a fan of the series when you were approached for this? Did you know Hatchet 1 and 2?
I didn't know anything about it at all.
So what attracted you to the project?
The fact that Adam Green just offered me the part on a silver platter.
And at that point, did you check out the first two, or did you? I mean, your character doesn't really need to know the plots of the first two. So, I mean, did you do the research, or?
Well, I'm a reasonably intelligent human being, so I'm always going to do my due diligence. So yeah, I looked at clips of the first two, although I knew they weren't really going to be relevant because he wasn't going to be directing it. But I looked at sort of the response to it and some of the reviews and how people sort of thought it was a cut above your typical slasher milieu and how it was kind of cleverly done. And I looked at some of the actors that had been in one and two, and it just kind of seemed like fun and a good idea.
Yeah, this film is like going to a horror convention. It's just so packed full of genre people. I mean, you've got Daniel Harris from the Halloween movies. Kane Hodder, of course, plays the monster from the Friday the 13th movies. Derek Mears, who played Jason in the remake, Friday the 13th remake, is in it as well. Caroline Williams from Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Was it
Sid Haig?
Sid Haig has an uncredited cameo. I don't know if that's a spoiler or not.
Oops.
Did it feel? What was the atmosphere on the, outside of the working conditions? I mean, was it a fun shoot?
Well, they stuck me and Cody Snyder and Derek and Perry in the same hotel, and we had to go to the set pretty much every day together. So that was kind of a fun bonding experience today, because it was about a 40-minute drive out to the swamp every day, so we would be cracking each other up in the cars and on the way back and stuff like that. And of course, if you kind of put your thinking cap on, you realize that everything we shot in the swamp, it was all nights. So we basically had like a 6 p.m. call to about 6 in the morning, you know, for about 8 out of 9 days in a row.
Wow. No. Doesn't anybody shoot day for night anymore?
I would think, you know, some of that stuff would be shot in a studio, you know, some of it. You know, you'd have your establishing shot, like old school, you have your establishing shots, and then you're on this kind of set. You didn't realize that it was all shot in the swamp. When you had said that earlier, Zach, I'm kind of like, wow, that was really all in an actual swamp. I thought maybe, you know, a couple shots, but then we've got, you know, stuff happening. That is crazy.
Yeah, the look of the film is really good. Yeah. I mean, it really, I don't know what the budget was, but it looks like a bigger budget probably than it really was.
Yeah.
Well, the interesting thing about it is that Hatchet 3 is actually one-third the budget of Hatchet 1, and yet I think visually it looks about 10 times better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's kind of due to the fact that you're A, on location, and B, using these really badass red cameras, and C, having someone like BJ McDonald, who's a camera operator, and, you know, and really kind of know and has worked on a movies, to kind of sort of give it a little bit more of a big budget feel.
Mm-hmm.
No, it does. It was cinematic. It didn't have that we shot on video feel. You know, it had that. It was cinematic.
Exactly.
Every shot was well designed and purposely, not just, okay, aim the camera here, let's get this shot done. Everything was done purposely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's fair.
Mm-hmm. When Adam approached you to do the film, had he been a fan of your other genre work, and was he like, you got to do this, I have to have you in this movie, or how did that whole thing go down with him?
Well, the interesting thing is that I think he and PJ got together, and they both kind of came up with the idea of maybe offering it to me, and so the first person I spoke to was BJ, since he was the director on the phone. And I've told this story a bunch of times, but it's a pretty good one, which is, you know, he got on the phone and I said, he was actually in the swamp on his cell phone. There's actually reception there, if you can believe it. And I said, so seriously, what can I look forward to in terms of the shoot? And he goes, well, I'm not going to lie to you. It's going to be hot. It's going to be long. It's going to be exhausting. You're going to get bitten to shit. But we're going to make a kick-ass movie that you're really, really going to be proud of. But I'm going to tell you right now, at least when we're in the swamp, it's kind of going to be like going to war every day. So I don't want to sugarcoat it for you, because most likely it's not really going to be that fun from a physical standpoint. And I said, that's exactly what I wanted to hear. I didn't want to hear anyone sort of, you know, sell me a trip to Disneyland when I know full well it's going to be, like, rough. So thanks for your honesty. And that's when I pretty much kind of decided to sign on.
Hmm. And how many nights did you shoot in the swamp?
We shot 8 nights in the swamp. I think we shot a total of 18, but I only shot 8 in the swamp and 2 in the police station and in the jail cells. So I only worked probably 10 of the 18 nights, I think.
Wow. Now, years ago, I got to know Kane Hodder a little bit through the conventions, and at the time, his favorite practical joke was to go into a crowded elevator and pass wind. Does he still do that? Is that still...
There's no elevators in the swamp.
Well, I mean, he's like a 7-year-old,
gotcha.
Basically.
Tell him that to his face.
First of all, quite honestly, I don't think I ever went up and down in an elevator with Kane Hodder even once. But he might have done that. He might have done that. The thing about Kane that was so interesting is that, you know, he's this big, strong guy, and you think that he would be kind of impervious to things. But you know what he's really super picky about?
What's that?
Whether or not his hotel room is really quiet. If he's, like, on the street or anywhere near any, like, street noise or anything noise that's, like, going on in the hotel, he will switch rooms until he finds a super quiet place where he's can be really silent.
That's interesting. Is he into meditation or something?
I have no idea. I think he's just not into noise or something like that, but I just think that, you know, you see this big, strong, powerful guy, and you think, well, maybe he doesn't give a shit about something like that. But then it turns out, you know, that he's kind of this quiet, reflective guy who just wants his peace and quiet. It's kind of interesting.
That's great, yeah. I don't know if Caden wants people to know that, necessarily.
Oh, now they do.
I actually know that about Caden.
It doesn't matter whether Caden wants people to know it or not. The point is that it's like, if people or badgering him or whatever, he'll just find some quiet place to go off by himself. Uh-huh. I'm not trying to say that he's a prima donna. I'm just saying you probably think that he's sort of more of a big, boisterous guy, and he is that too, but he's also got that really quiet, reflective side.
Right, right, right.
He does, actually. Yeah, he does a lot of charity work, and he also is really into animal rights and things like that. So, yeah, Kane's a good guy.
Yeah.
Fun guy. I got to ask you, Zach, I got to interrupt here. This is Todd, the producer, and I've got to ask you a little bit about, I know we're here to promote Hatchet 3, and that's awesome, but I've been trying to get you on Night Watch for like 5 years, which is my show that I do here for the network, and we've been trying to get you on there, and we just never have had any luck. And the reason I wanted to bring you on is because I'm a fan of all the movies you did before this, like Waxwork and Warlock the Armageddon, Waxwork 2, Tales from the Crypt, even the Hitchhiker TV series I loved. That's what I love about you. I love the fact that there for a while you were kind of the dude. You were like the guy we could identify with as the audience. You were the guy we were rooting for, especially like in Waxwork. I thought it was a fantastic movie, highly underrated, and the sequel's the same way. Those were imaginative, fun movies. What was it like doing the Waxwork series? How was it doing those films?
Hold on a second because I got something down my throat.
Okay, no problem.
That's the problem with these live shows.
That's not a problem at all.
Todd, I totally agree on a Waxwork movies. Totally underrated, man.
They are. People don't get it.
Nope.
You know, that's funny you say that because I think a lot of fans really like them and they approach me about the fact that they like them all the time. So it doesn't feel underappreciated to me.
Right. I'm looking at the mainstream. I mean, like right now, I think those movies should be on Blu-ray. We should have a 3-disc special edition because I just love them that much. But I'm probably being unrealistic to think that. You know, I'm like,
I think it goes back to like when they came out. They were direct to video, and I mean, for us as movie fans, those are made for movie fans. And I don't think it had the kind of mainstream acceptance as other films did, and it just didn't carry over to like the lore of horror fans where it's like, oh yeah, you just, you know, you're breathing that movie, you're always mentioning that movie. It's just kind of there, you know, in its own little space. But I think it needs to be more, even in the horror community, more mainstreamed.
Well, you know, Rob, I saw the first Waxwork in a theater. It played.
I saw both on video. I thought they both came direct to video.
No, so that first one played for a while.
Did it? Okay, yeah. That's great. That's even better to hear.
It did well in the theater.
Yeah, the first one, we went to the premiere, was at the Chinese Theater.
Oh, yeah.
Nice.
It definitely was in theaters at least for a week, if not two.
Actually, it played for about a month here in the Midwest, here in Kansas City, and we had like, it was like beating these other movies, these blockbuster films. It was awesome because they held it over. It was only supposed to be there for like a week or two, and they kept it because it was like, it was beating all the odds. I mean, it even went up against Elvira, and it was winning against Elvira's movie, so that was pretty cool.
That's awesome. I didn't know that. That's very cool.
Yep. Good movie.
I mean, here's the thing about Waxwork. When they sent me the script, or I shouldn't say they, when Tony Hickok sent me the script, he was a huge Gremlins fan. So, it was his, according to him, I was like pretty much the first person that he really wanted to work with. I don't know, for whatever reason. So, what he did was, he sent me the script, and he set up a meeting with me. So I read the script, and I'm going to be totally honest with you. I was like, I didn't think it was good. I thought the premise was good. I thought the execution was kind of poor, particularly with the dialogue, because the dialogue at that time sounded like American dialogue written by a British guy, which exactly is pretty much what it was, because Tony's from London, and he was kind of trying to approximate American dialogue and not doing all that well. So he called my manager or something like that and set up a meeting, and I met him at Hugo's down on Santa Monica in Los Angeles, and I was pretty much just doing it sort of as a courtesy. And I went and I met the guy, and he was so engaging and he was so charming, and the guy can sell like ice cubes to Eskimos. He's that good of a salesman. And I told him about all my concerns, and everything I had a concern with, he basically was like, don't worry about it. That's going to go away. It's going to change. It's going to be altered. That's not going to be that way. That's not going to be. And then everything that I liked, he was like, oh, yes, that's going to totally be that way. And this, that, and the other thing. And here's the set design. And he brought this, you know, he brought this like portfolio with him, and it had sketches of the sets and the designs and the this and that. And by the time he was done, it was basically like he was doing this full-on presentation across the table from me at this, you know, pretty much almost like a diner. By the time it was over, I was pretty much like, where do I sign? So it was really a sales job by the director that got me to do that movie. And then he showed me a short film that he had done called Rockabye Baby. It was only like 20 minutes long. But I was like, I want to see some footage of what this guy shot and what it looks like. And when he showed me the short film, it was very stylishly done. I mean, that's really where I was basically like, I'm in. So I did the first movie, and you know, I think it's cute. I think it's charming. I think it's silly. I think it's very Tony. It's very much Tony's personality, and with his love of horror movies and his kind of boyish charm and his occasional love of sadism. It's just all him.
I think it was also a little bit of a product of its time. You know, like stuff like Monster Squad had come out around the same time, mm-hmm. and it had that kind of feel. There was a playfulness to it that I think really touched a lot of people. Then now, did you find, Zach, that all those concerns that you had, were they actually addressed, or was it just the sales pitch?
Oh, no, they were. What he did that was so good was he said, listen, I don't really know how to write American dialogue. You're right. What I'm going to do is I'm going to get some good actors, and I'm going to tell you basically what needs to be said in terms of crucial points here, and you guys are going to say it in your own tongue. You're going to figure it out. And so we would get together, and it didn't take very long. We would just sort of improv a little bit, or take the lines, and you know, if the line was something like, oh dear, we have to stop for petrol, we would turn into, oh shit, we're almost out of gas.
Right.
So it wasn't brain surgery. You know what I mean? We understood what Tony was trying to say. He just didn't really know all of the lingo. So since we were American and we were basically kids, we just did it for him. Mm-hmm. And that really fixed, I think, a lot of the problems with the script, because it just sounded very arch. It sounded like, you know, he was trying to write American kids, and instead it was kind of sounding like... you know, Downton Abbey, and it just wasn't working.
And then how did the sequel come about?
Well, I guess the, you know, it did very, very well on video, Waxwork, when it finally hit VHS. I think it did extremely well. And so they asked him to do a second one, and he did the second one, and I believe, I really don't know if this is true or not, but I remember, I think he wrote it, like, in just a fever pitch. I think he wrote the whole thing, tumbled out of him in like 2 or 3 days. I really think he was sort of under the gun, and he wrote it kind of quickly, and just whatever popped into his head. That's why the movie has kind of a mad quality to it, because it does sort of seem like whatever. It seems like the writer was really following his impulses. So he was like, we'll have this, and then we'll go here, and then this will be a sword fight, and then they'll sword fight through time, and he'll be in a Saturday Night Fever outfit fighting in the mall, like in Dawn of the Dead, and then all of a sudden they'll be in a Godzilla movie. And then, so it has this crazy kind of just follow your impulse quality to it that, you know, either some people either love that movie and they think it's batshit crazy and hilarious, or some people just think it's dumb and don't like it.
Right. There is a dreamlike quality to it that could be construed as a nightmare. And it does have that, I mean, where you might say the first one, this is an absurd concept. This takes that absurdity to the 10th level, which is great. And I think a lot of movie fans appreciate that you're sending up Alien and The Haunting and Dawn of the Dead. And I mean, for that kind of reflection and for a horror film, that was a big thing for us then when we had watched it, mm-hmm. when it first came out. It was like, wow, no one's doing that. Now it would be like, yeah, of course, we've had all the spoofs and we've had the scary movies and all those kind of films, but no one was really doing that then, kind of referencing, you know, the industry that way.
Right. There, what was not Fear No Evil, but what in the early 80s was a movie where Dennis Christopher?
Fade to Black.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very good film.
Good movie.
Right, but that was the closest thing to that. I didn't have, but to have, you know, I forget what year or part two was, but to have a movie reference Dawn of the Dead, which at that time wasn't a mainstream name. There, you know, mm-hmm. like Dawn of the Dead was still a cult midnight film, and if you read Fangoria, you knew about Dawn of the Dead, but it's not something you saw on television or whatever. You had to, if you were a kid, you couldn't even go see it. So to have a movie reference it after you had seen it and kind of been like one of the few that were into it, even knew what it was really kind of like, you know, speaking to you as a young fan, And I think that emotionally bonded a lot of people to the film and to you, Zach, in your performance in both the films.
Well, you know, Tony, it's funny you mentioned Fangoria, because Tony was a huge Fangoria reader. I used to go over to his house, and he had this sort of above-ground bathtub, you know, those kind of ornate English bathtubs that sort of sit on four little legs and are just sort of like not sunken into the ground, but sort of like you just fill them with pitchers of water. Right, and so I'd come over to his house, and he'd be up in his bathroom, and I'd come in, and he'd be in this like soapy tub reading Fangoria. So he had been reading Fangoria he'd been reading Fangoria since he was a kid. So I mean, the fact of the matter is that, you know, I mean, he was always, and still to this day, is obsessed with horror and loves it and doesn't really understand why it's kind of like the redheaded stepchild of the genres. You know, he doesn't understand why it isn't accorded more respect, especially when, you know, like if you look in Waxwork 2, there's that big tribute to The Haunting, right? The Claire Bloom movie that Robert Wise did in the 60s with Bruce Campbell and Sophie Ward and Marina Sirtis. So, yeah, I mean, you know, he was, and look at some of the greats that he puts I think it's the first Waxwork. In the first Waxwork, he's got John Ireland, and he's got Patrick McNee, and he's got David Carradine. You know, he had a lot of reverence for what he was doing, and he really loved it. He really believed in it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Joe Dante is probably one of my favorite directors, and I think that's true of him as well. I mean, his movies are just a who's who of 50s sci-fi stars and whatnot, television stars. That's one thing I've always loved about his movies, just spotting people.
You have Kenneth Toby is in Gremlins, you know, he sells the smokeless ashtray to Hoyt Axton and stuff like that. So yeah, there are tons of people in Joe's movies. He's a real lover of old films, and he probably, I would say Joe Dante's probably seen more films and definitely more cartoons than any other human being I've ever met, except maybe Quentin Tarantino.
Just for everyone that's tuning in late, this is the Movies Hate You show. We're with Zach Galligan, our special guest this week, and we'll continue. Zach, are you a genre fan, or were you a genre fan before Gremlins? Like, what is your opinion of the horror genre or sci-fi genre?
Oh yeah, I mean, I was. I grew up in New York City, and we had a local television station called WPIX. In fact, we still do. And every Saturday
Chiller,
night, I think
right?
it was Chiller Theater. Yeah, and so I'd see that with the fingered hand come out of the swamp, and it used to scare the crap out of me when I was a kid. I mean, it really, even the opening, I remember the one time, I think the first time, God, this is so long ago, but I can still remember it. I think the first time I saw the intro with the music, I can remember just thinking to myself, no, wrong, scary, bad, and like running out of the room. Just pure fear words that go in your head when you're little and you're not really intellectual. You're just thinking instinctively, just like, no, wrong, get away, leave, fear. And I just remember sprinting from the room because it scared the crap out of me. And then everyone was like, come back, it's over, don't worry, it's fine, you know. And I was like, probably crying, I would imagine, because I was probably 4 or 5. It was probably like 1969. Uh-huh. And I came back in, and to my horror, it was Steve McQueen in The Blob. And The Blob is not really that scary, except, I think, for the beginning, when the meteor lands and cracks open and the little blobby thing is on the inside and the old man goes and pokes it with the stick and then it goes on his arm and starts like eating his arm and absorbing him. That is really, still to this day, kind of disturbing, the idea that there's this like strange organism that just can like kind of like flesh eating bacteria that can just sort of eat away at you. It's horrible.
Yeah, it's a simple concept, but it does definitely go right to the
it's our biggest fear, being consumed by some kind of something you can't see, or some kind of bacteria, or something that's just a human reaction to that.
Mm-hmm. I think for me, it was Creature from the Black Lagoon when I was four.
What was that, Zach?
Yeah, no, sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. With the Creature from the Black Lagoon, that's what scared you, the gill man climbing over the boat?
I think so. I think I remember vividly, maybe 4 or 5 years old, sitting in my dad's lap. I grew up in Nebraska. We had our own horror host, a local host. That memory is so vivid to me. And I think also at the same time, Grandmama from the Addams Family scared the hell out of me. And I don't know why, but
scary looking.
I love the show, and we always watch the show. But my family would, I would go out of the room during the opening montage, and whenever I would see, whenever Grandmama was on the screen, I would turn my head, and then after the montage, it was okay. She wasn't in every episode, so it was okay.
What got me was the Suspiria trailer with that combing the hair and the turns around and it's a skull.
Mm-hmm.
That did me in. That and the chiller hand, like Zach, because I grew up in Central Jersey, so we both had PIX, and that was that Saturday afternoon, whatever, it was like 6 or 7 o'clock at night, I think it was, and that hand would come out. That was that did it for me too. It was just creepy. The sound effects and the music to that was just, I think that's what really pushed it over the edge.
Mm-hmm.
Just so grim.
But it's a... Yeah. You know, sorry, Zach, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I have two kids, and my youngest... wow.
Hey, and a duck.
And
somebody
a duck.
Has a duck.
Our sponsor.
No, that was my Seahawks news. I get a double buzz on my phone whenever I get a new article about the Seahawks.
Oh, nice. Okay, it was an app alert. Yeah,
I was going to guess that. But I was just about to say that my daughter Casey's 7, and I introduced Gremlins to her, I think, Christmas before last, and was a little unsure about whether she was old enough for it. She wanted to watch it. You know, she clung to me the entire time, was scared, but loved it. And at the end of the movie, she was just, I want to watch it again.
Mm-hmm.
She literally wanted to watch it twice in a row. And I think, you know, a time will tell, but maybe that is her Creature from the Black Lagoon.
That's her chiller
memory.
Hand.
Yeah, that's the, you know, braving through, pushing through that fear to get to the catharsis of whatever it is at the end.
Yeah.
I suppose she'll remember that.
Zach, I have a non-genre question for you related to the at the time you made Gremlins and you were doing films in the 80s and early 90s. The kind of like the Brat Pack was happening at the same time. And what was your connection with? Were you mixed in with those guys at all, or
as far as the Brat Pack was concerned? I mean, I was basically almost one of them. I tried out for the Breakfast Club. I screen tested for St. Elmo's Fire. I read for Pretty in Pink, all those John Hughes movies. I certainly knew Charlie very well, Sheen very well. I had met Emilio a bunch of times. I did a TV movie with Molly Ringwald. I was very good friends with Anthony Michael Hall and Robert Downey Jr. And I had met Rob Lowe on a number of occasions. We had dated the same girls. So I kind of felt like Judd Nelson was a friend of mine, So I really kind of, Andrew McCarthy and I were always going up for the same roles. I don't know if you can see that or not, but... So I basically met every single one of those people and was on a first-name basis with them, and came incredibly close to sort of being in that pack. It just never really quite worked out.
On film, I mean, off screen, you were all friends, and that's where I think I was getting at. What I was getting at is that, like, for me, watching those films, you know, I'm watching Some Kind of Wonderful, and then I watch, you know, Waxwork. To me, that's you're a contemporary of all those people, and it's kind of like, It's just a little missing piece of the puzzle. Where's the movie that you're in with them? Like, I needed to see that because everything else was there. It was like clear that you were right there with them.
Well, I think I got a little bit of that when I did the TV movie called Surviving about teenage suicide, me and Molly, and they put us on the cover of People magazine for the same week as my 21st birthday. So that was a hell of a birthday present. And nice. What was interesting about that is that, you know, if you think, sorry, I just kissed my cat. That's what that noise was. if you think about what the media was like back in 1985, if you went to a newsstand, there were like 8 magazines. Now you go to a magazine rack and there are like 800 magazines. Mm-hmm. But basically in 1985, there was People, Us, Time, Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report, Sports Illustrated, and Interview Magazine. That's pretty much it. It's pretty much all there was. And there were comic books, and there was, like, you know, Better Homes and Gardens and all that
crossword,
shit.
Crossword puzzles.
Crossword puzzles and comic books and stuff like that. But if you were on the cover of Time Magazine, it was sudden fucking impact. I mean, every single person read Time Magazine. It's not like there's, you know, now where there's a billion websites and they're like, oh yeah, I didn't see that. Oh, whatever, this, that, and the other thing. So when Molly and I were on the cover of People Magazine, what was so weird about it was I got more recognition and more, well, I guess just public recognition from that cover than I ever did for any actual movie, including Gremlins, that I ever performed in my entire career. So I guess that kind of tells you that the media really is king, and that a lot of people, you know, a lot of people, ow, Duncan, don't jump on me, honey. I'm talking on the phone. A lot of people know, it's weird to think of this, but a lot of people know Brad Pitt from, like, him being on Entertainment Tonight, and have probably only seen, like, one or two movies that he's been in. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, they sort of know some of these people from being a media figure as opposed to just, like, actually seeing their films. So that was kind of weird.
Yeah, they know about their marriages or whatever, you know, failures, whatever's happened in their personal life, but they haven't bought the ticket. So, yeah, so you're saying that the Brat Pack was basically a media invention, and there were so, you know, the actual Brat Pack were tons of people who were all friends at that time in Hollywood. But they just focused on a certain amount of them.
Yeah, it was like whoever was in this movie, who got cast in this movie, was now part of the Rat Pack. And then whoever didn't get cast in this movie was like, you notice they never put Kevin Bacon in with the Rat Pack, because they, I guess they thought he was like a little bit older. He was like a little bit older. But he knew all those people, and he went up for all of those movies. And you know what I mean?
Right.
So now, it's like, why did you get put in and this person didn't? It's all only through a fluke of, like, casting. You know what I mean?
Right, and you see that. There are a lot of kind of, you know, like Eric Stoltz as well. He's another one who's kind of like, he's in there. He's contemporary. He's done, you know, a couple films, but it's just not, it seems like either Hughes or the media was kind of inventing that.
Right, was it the willingness to be put in that group that I mean, did Kevin Bacon, for instance, just not want to do that?
Well, I think what it was that there was an article in New York Magazine, a front page cover article about it, that was actually, and it said, it called it the Brat, it just said the Brat Pack on the cover, and it had a picture of people, basically the cast of St. Elmo's Fire. Right. And to be perfectly honest, without naming names, it was a pretty disparaging article about sort of how spoiled and entitled all of the L.A. kids who were in that pack kind of were acting, that they were basically 21 years old and they thought they owned the universe. And at that time, that seemed like an incredibly sacrilegious thing to do. Now, of course, you're so used to seeing Paris Hilton and Lindsay Lohan and all of Justin Bieber and all of these 20-year-olds in clubs that just seemed kind of passé. But this was sort of the first time that anyone had ever said, look at these 21-year-old kids. They're like ruling nightlife in Los Angeles with limos and the Hard Rock Cafe, and they're picking up all these hot chicks, and who do they think they are? So it was kind of a pejorative thing that then the media latched onto. So I was kind of, you know, quite honestly, sort of glad that I hadn't kind of been lumped into that article.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was kind of a dig.
Right. I think I remember reading that. Now, the fact that you're from New York, is that another reason why maybe you weren't lumped in with those? Because didn't they all kind of go to the same high school? Was that part of it?
I think it was really very much more an L.A. phenomenon. I don't recall really. The only actor that seemed to be a kind of non-L.A. actor was Andrew McCarthy, who I believe comes from Chicago originally, and then became kind of a New York actor. But he was really the only one, I think, who... And Anthony Michael Hall lived in New York, too, because he lived about a block and a half away from me and basically would just kind of come over whenever he felt like it. And it was kind of largely a media creation, and most of the relationships, you know, Rob Lowe and Sean Penn and all of those guys and Emilio, they all went to high school together. So, yeah, there was definitely some of that.
Now, when you talked about your recognition changing, are you talking about, like, walking down the street and people just coming up to you and saying they know? I mean, with that kind of recognition?
That's exactly what I'm talking about. Yeah, I'm just talking about the sheer volume of, like, places you could no longer go where you were anonymous.
It's like...
Go ahead.
They say the difference between movie stars and television stars is people who are on television... people tend to think that they're a member of their family because they see them in their house all the time. They're always in the living room. And I think maybe by extension, the people who are in the tabloids are also in their house because that's where they read the tabloids. So maybe they feel a little bit more closer to Brad Pitt, not having seen his movies, but because they're always reading about him. Does that make sense? Maybe?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's certainly a feasible explanation. You know, I mean, I think that there are always about 40 or 50 people who for a period of time are the topics of conversation, and some of those people drop off the radar and some people drop back in, and then new people come in, and it's just sort of like, you know, it's like the American equivalent, I guess, of a royal family is like who's hot right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, now it seems to be, I mean, I don't read the tabloids, but I see them on the newsstands, and now it seems to be like reality TV stars seem to be the new celebrities. I mean, I'll look at...
People that have done nothing, really.
Yeah, exactly. The headline will be, Kendra has Nick's baby. I don't know any of these people.
Who they are.
Am I supposed to be shocked? Am I supposed to be happy? I don't know who they are.
That's so, like The Bachelorette or something, or, you know, one of these shows, or the, you know, but... But then, you know, they have, like, the Kardashians who no one really knows what they do or whatever. You know, like, that kind of thing as well.
Right, people got famous for other reasons.
Yeah, or famous for being famous.
Yeah.
Do you want to...
Yeah, and I think that's really done... the last 10 or 12 years, I think, have really done a disservice to the generation that's growing up now because, like, I mean, I just came from... A couple of hours ago, teaching a class at NYU. That's what I do when I'm not acting. And you know, the kids are great. I'm not going to disparage the kids, but they definitely have this idea that kind of like being famous means just sort of existing and being cool instead of anything like hard work and you know, hours and hours of study and trying applying your craft. I think a lot of them are. You know, some of them realize that, and I think a lot of them just think that they're kind of cool and cool-looking, and then just this huge show is going to be thrown in their lap, and I'm like, you're delusional.
Right, people used to want to get a good, you know, good role, a good script. Now they just want to get on a show. I have to get in the cast of something, you know, some kind of reality ensemble thing.
Well, they want their own show. That's what's so crazy.
Yeah.
It's right. Like you should change the Andy Warhol. And the Andy Warhol dictum is, in the future, everyone will get their own show for 15 minutes.
He's, you know, he was right. He was right to a certain degree.
Yeah.
We could film our own show here, put it up there, and millions of people can watch it. No process, no producers to go through, nothing.
You just got to click.
Yeah. What, we're coming down to the, we're winding down to the end here, Zach, with our time. What do you got? No, Hatchet 3 is out now, VOD, select theaters. Please check it out. It's an incredibly fun ride from start to finish and bloody as hell. But what's next on the movie front for you, Zach?
Well, I'm happy to say that I'm actually reading some scripts now, and I don't really have a definitive answer, but okay. I'm looking at some scripts, and some of them are definitely in the horror genre. So, I mean, naturally, that's kind of a natural extension coming from Hatchet 3. So I will I'll let you know as soon as I know.
Now, every now and then, the rumor of Gremlins 3 pops up. And,
that's right.
I think recently, actually, it popped up that Joe let something slip that maybe possibly he might be possibly working on a treatment. Do you know anything more than we know?
Well, I only know what they published in the thing about it hit the news about probably exactly a month ago, is that Warner Brothers is going to do a full reboot, and they already have a producer and a writer ready to go. So there's not going to be a Gremlins 3. It's going to be a CGI reboot.
Oh, geez. Oh, see, geez. You should be reading the trades.
I had to ask.
What's wrong with you? Well, I'm hoping that, you know, Zach and Phoebe will be in it. So
at least,
yeah.
I think the odds that Phoebe will be in it are non-existent. I mean, she has this really successful store. She has a very happy marriage. She's got two lovely kids. She hasn't acted basically since 1995. I imagine she has almost no interest in it. Most actresses don't want to go back to the screen and have their older image preserved, even though she looks basically identical to what she looked like 20 years ago. My guess is she would not do it. I, of course, would do anything.
Well, they could CGI her, couldn't they?
There you go.
They could probably CGI her. Actually, you know, did you see Dicey Cloverfield?
No.
Yeah, we did.
Cloverfield? Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, the J.J. Abrams monster movie?
Yep, we liked it.
Yeah.
Loved it.
Okay, so you know the dark-haired girl in that movie, Odette Eustman?
Yeah.
Remember she played, like, the girlfriend? She is such the new version of Phoebe Cates. It's crazy. She, like, reminds me so much of her. When I saw that movie, I was kind of taken aback.
Yeah.
We could see that. Yeah,
she also did some other horror movie where she's in her underwear on the cover. I can't remember what it's called, but it was pretty good.
That's awesome. I have to say, last thing is Gremlins 2, in my opinion, is criminally underrated. I think that's I've watched that as many times as I've watched Gremlins, and always find something new in it. It wasn't successful at the box office. It didn't live up to expectations, I guess. I don't know what the expectations were, but do you...
Yeah, it was packed when I saw it. I don't get that, how the studios do that stuff.
They put it up against another movie, didn't they?
I think
they?
Maybe that it came out at the same time as something else.
Yeah.
Zach, what are your feelings on part two?
I like part two. I don't love it as much as the first one, but I like it a lot, and I think it could have been just as successful, if not more so, if Warner Brothers had moved it from its original spot of, like, May 14th or something like that. It was going to be the movie that kicked off the summer. Maybe it was even a week earlier, like May 10th, May 3rd, kind of like that Iron Man slot now is. Mm-hmm. And they moved it and put it right up against Dick Tracy, and it got clobbered. Yeah, and the reason why they did that was because it tested at the time higher than any other movie in Warner Brothers history. So they got super, super cocky. And they were like, you know what, we're going to, you know, screw you, Warren Beatty and Madonna. We're going to show you. And they just underestimated the lust of the American people for all things Madonna at that time. And we got killed. And we got killed the opening weekend, and then, of course, the media jumps on and goes, oh, what a disappointment. And then that filters in, and everybody goes, oh, I was kind of psyched for it, but no, I guess it's not good because people aren't going to see it. And it becomes this vicious cycle, whereas if they'd opened it on the opening weekend, it could have been like $40 million opening weekend, and then it would have, like, you know, the franchise would have continued. So I basically think that decision, which was made by Warner Brothers, I think that decision is kind of what killed that first incarnation of the franchise, to be honest.
Mm. Well, let me tell you this. You could feel good knowing that everyone still loves Gremlins and Gremlins 2, but where the hell's Dick Tracy? No one cares.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, also, you know, it's funny because when the Blu-ray came out, I think about a year ago, there was a review in the New York Times, and it was a rave. And the New York Times really didn't like it when it came out in 1990. but now they've caught up to it and how clever and subversive and ahead of its time it was, and they gave it a rave. And Joe Dante tweeted the link to me with a little tweet that said, "Vindicated at last!" Exclamation point. And we read the thing together and had a great, great laugh about the fact that it was always that good. They were just too snobby and stupid to realize it at the time.
Exactly.
Agreed. Agreed.
All right. So I think we have to get out of here.
Todd, are you throwing us off? Or we?
It's about that time, guys. It's about that time.
All right. Zach, we want to thank you so much for joining us tonight, man. This was really fun. We could probably talk for 5 more hours about all this stuff.
We could, but I think Zach would be kicking us by then.
Zach would just hang up on us, and we'd keep talking about it.
All right, gang. Well, thanks. It was fun, and next time I have something coming out, we'll do it again.
Oh, I'd love
Definitely.
It.
Great. We will hook up again. You're always welcome here, man. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Zach.
All right, guys.
Take care.
All right, good night. That was awesome, man.
Yeah, there you go.
Zach Galligan joining us for tonight. Gremlins 2, Waxwork. Go check all those out. Go rent them.
Go see Hatchet 3. You know, people complain about there aren't horror movies in theaters anymore. There's one right now you can go see.
Hatchet 3. If you can't get out of the house, if you're kind of a shut-in or kind of a, whatever, you can't get out of
there. We're not fortunate enough to live in New York.
Yeah, if you don't have $12 for a movie, you only have $5, you can rent it on VOD if you have cable.
Mm-hmm.
Hatchet 3. Seriously. And yeah, I'm the last person to fanboy out, but it was like a fanboy orgy of blood and craziness. I would totally check that out. Unlike any other fanboy. Unlike the Avengers. This was like the horror Avengers.
It is.
In a sense. That would be good. A horror Avengers. Mm. With like Freddy and Jason and Chucky and they did all that.
Get my agent on the phone.
All right, Todd. Thank you very much. This has been the Movies Hate You Show, sponsored by WildEyeReleasing.com. WildEyeReleasing.com. Mr. Reed, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for arranging our excellent guest tonight. Todd, thank you for producing.
Of course.
And we will catch you all next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Yay, we're so happy.
We did.